So if you follow the Musk industry, let me try again. So if you follow Musk industry closely, you know that there is big news that SpaceX, very likely confirmed, is going public here in 2026. There have been some posts shared on X that Elon has replied to. SpaceX is getting ready for a public offering, probably mid-26 or so. This is on the back of Starship having gone through multiple tests, and it looks like the signal that I'm getting from this is that the company is very close to having Starship ready to go for just general missions. And one of the big technologies that has been getting a lot of traction as of late is solar-powered AI satellites, mainly because of the huge bottleneck that is coming down the pike here with energy in powering these data centers, these AI centers, to actually power the AI. And satellites in space is one of the best ways to overcome that bottleneck, because you're not dealing with the constraints of doing AI on Earth from a power perspective. You literally just shoot satellites in space, and then you put them in a sort of sun synchronous orbit, which means that the solar panels always point at the sun, which means that you have a 24/7 power source for your very power hungry AI satellites. And then when they heat up from computing all that stuff, they just radiate that heat away into the vast emptiness of space. And so the only way to have that at scale is by having a gigantic rocket that goes up all the time. Well, lo and behold, SpaceX has been working on this thing called the Starship, right? And one of the most exciting things about this is that this is actually real. And Larry is joining me for today's discussion. Those of you on my channel know Larry very, very deeply. Just an awesome human being and just filled with knowledge and wisdom. But what's interesting about Larry is that, number one, Larry is an investor in SpaceX. He's an investor in XAI. He's an investor in a bunch of different outfits as well, of private industry. And so not only do I want to get his take on the news of SpaceX going public, but we also want to drill down sort of his thought process of how he came about investing in SpaceX in the first place, investing in XAI, and sort of his angel investing journey, his private company journey, investing in those companies. What are the things he looks for? Because there's just so much there to learn from. Because if you just watch the SpaceX journey, they went from a company that everybody thought was, excuse my French, fucking crazy, to now probably being the largest IPO of all time in history. So, Larry, what do you think is happening?
You know, what is happening is quite consistent with what has happened historically with SpaceX. So if you want to cast your mind back to the year 2002, I know some of you weren't alive at that point, but if you cast your mind back to 2002, SpaceX was funded originally with a $30.5 million funding from Elon. But almost every year since then, the value of that company has almost doubled. I mean,
wow.
From 2002 to 2010, the valuation jumped by such an amount that the early funding in 2010 was about $1 billion. And then, you know, valuations rose 2012 to $2.4 billion. In 2015, it rose to $15 billion. So there's a company just 10 years old, valued at $15 billion.
And,
you know, and then 2017, $21 billion. 2019, $33 billion. So you get jumped to 2021, $100 billion. 2024, $200 billion. And here we are in, you know, 2025, and what is the valuation jump to?
500?
800? $100 billion.
How rare is that?
Well, you have to look at the AI companies in recent years to be anything remotely close to that. I mean, we have XAI, whose valuation has jumped to $230 billion, and it's, what, 3 or 4 years old?
Yeah.
You've got OpenAI, whose valuation, you know, rose to $200 billion within 3 years of it launching its first product. So it's very, very unusual, and it's very difficult. And the question is, are we in a bubble? A lot of people have proposed that, yeah, we're in a bubble. Others have, you know, said, no, this is pretty much powerful. This is the right thing. But
yeah,
the thing about the valuation of SpaceX is that it is an N of one. It is the only private company, that has achieved success in space. I should probably also admit that, you know, there's a Rocket Lab that has actually gone public, is profitable, has a good valuation. But, I mean, they're in a different level of the game right now. I mean, they're trying to get to SpaceX's level of the game, but right now, there's only one, you know, high-functioning, you know, space company. So with the exception of Rocket Lab, there's no other private space company, dedicated space company, that's profitable.
Yeah.
And there's certainly none that are at the kind of levels of profit that are being generated right now by Starlink. But profit's not the magic bullet for the valuation. This is the magic bullet for the valuation. The magic bullet is the realization that space is the only solution to the future of AI.
Yeah.
So who would have thought a year and a half ago that space would have been the unlock for AI?
Nobody.
So, yeah. You know, a year ago, 2024, December, SpaceX was valued at $350 billion. And what was that valuation based on? One thing and one thing only, Starlink. Because the launch company, the launch part of SpaceX is marginally profitable.
Just for the audience that are not familiar, when we're talking about the launch business, we're talking about literally other companies using SpaceX rockets to put their stuff in space.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, you know, you asked about how I pick and choose companies to fund. I get almost on a daily basis another space company wanting to raise money. And one of the problems of those space companies wanting to raise money is so many of them are trying to build a rocket for their launch business. And I keep asking the same question. Why would you build a launch business in order to, you know, do communications in space or in order to do new propellant for space launch vehicles or a new energy, all the stuff that you want to do in space or this kind of experimentation or this kind of manufacturing space, why would you need a launch vehicle when, you know, you can buy from Rocket Lab or you can buy from SpaceX and soon you'll be able to buy from Jeff Bezos's company, Blue Origin, you'll be able to buy launch for not much more, if at all more, then you're going to be able to launch yourself. And the launch business is extremely risky, extremely capital intensive. It's pointless.
Can I play devil's advocate there real quick? So isn't the logic there? So knowing that SpaceX is now going down the path of putting likely to be their own AI satellites in space to power XAI's inference needs, Tesla's inference needs potentially, whatever, even renting out, you know, doing distributed inference, not only in their cars, but in space, basically creating a monopoly of sorts. What is SpaceX's incentive to actually give launch capacity to other companies when they know that the ROI they're going to get in launching their own inference satellites is going to be significantly greater than selling the business? Kind of similar to how they're doing it with Starlink today. with Falcon 9. It's like,
well, let
why
me
not
ask
just,
you this. Why yeah. are SpaceX today taking Starlink competitors to orbit?
This is a very good point.
SpaceX has traditionally focused on their launch business without any reference to other SpaceX businesses or requirement or interests. They've been extremely diligent in providing launch capacity to competitors as well as other space companies that don't compete with them. So SpaceX understands their launch business is their franchise. And to protect the franchise, what they do is open that launch business to everybody.
Mm.
And so, you know, who are their launch competitors? ULA, which is just Boeing and Northrop and Lockheed.
Disaster.
It's an absolute disaster. I mean,
unmitigated. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I've had debates with Tory Bruno, the CEO, online. And, you know, he's been very dismissive of things I say. But, I mean, basically, Tory Bruno is living in a cloud. It's the same cloud that, you know, Boeing and Lockheed are losing money. I mean, it's just they try to sell that company. Nobody would buy it.
Man.
Nobody would buy
That's
it.
Rough.
I mean, the company is worthless, in my judgment. It's worthless.
Yeah.
So, but nonetheless, you know, Elon has been extremely diligent. Elon and Gwyneth, or I should just say SpaceX, has been extremely diligent about preserving that launch business in, you know, as a completely independent launch company, open to everybody, priced at the best possible price they can afford to give people. And so the cost of launch has collapsed in recent years after ULA was no longer a monopoly, and the amount of capacity has expanded dramatically. So, you know, SpaceX launches 90% of US launches and about 60% of global launches.
Yeah.
They carry, and they're about to become 95%, 99%, because with Starship, their capacity for launch goes up dramatically and their price will collapse even further from where it is today.
Yeah. So, and for those that are not familiar, I just want to sort of explain this concept, because maybe they're asking, so why is Starship doing that? It's because Starship not only is a far larger rocket than Falcon 9, so I think it's like 10 times more mass to orbit per launch, something like that, Larry. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it depends. It depends on conditions and height.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's at least 10 times, or it could be as much as 20 times.
And the breakthrough is not just how much bigger it is, but it's the fact that it's a fully reusable rocket, meaning that when it comes back, it can literally go back again quickly after refueling it like a plane. So you're doing a lot more per launch, and you're doing it a lot more often. So the amount of stuff you can put in space is really, really large. And that's why the cost is going to come down a lot. It's because the actual cost of getting stuff into space is not going to be that much compared to what it was, especially during the ULA time, but even with Falcon 9, because you have such a big rocket and it's going up all the time. I just want to make sure I made that clear for the audience that's not perhaps familiar with the technology.
Yeah, so Falcon 9 can take 22 tons to orbit. And I'm talking about at its extreme capacity. Falcon Heavy can take 64 tons mass to orbit. Starship, the original Starship, the first version, could take 100 to 150 tons. This version of Starship, which is about to be launched, can take 200 to 250 tons. Block 2, the one that we've just watched being launched, can take 100 to 150 tons, but 200 to 250 tons, but the final goal is 400 tons.
Wow.
To low Earth orbit, which would be roughly 17 times Falcon 9.
Yeah.
So it depends on which version. So the original Block 1, which is now completed, testing is completed, was up to 150 tons. So that was, you know, about seven times. But block two, which is about to start being tested, we're talking about 10 to 12 times.
Man, that's insane. And so if I kind of go back.
But here's the other point that I think you haven't touched on.
Please.
Falcon 9 consists of a booster and a second stage. Only the booster can return to Earth. The second stage is lost.
Yeah.
And it takes between 2 and 7 weeks to refurbish it after a launch. And it returns to a barge in the sea and or a landing pad. Then has to be returned to the factory for refurbishment. Starship will return to the launch pad.
Crazy.
Will take, ultimately, this is going to be a year or two or three down the road. Ultimately, will take 1 hour to be refueled. It'll have to be cooled down first, but then it'll take an hour to refuel and then can be launched again. And
crazy.
Not the first stage, but the entire rocket.
Man.
So the cost of launch per ton will fall not by the difference in weight that it carries. That's kind of, it was a number I couldn't pull off the top of my head because it was such an unimportant number. But by the actual cost of the vehicle, because instead of throwing away half the cost of the vehicle, well, all other launch companies throw the whole cost of the vehicle. Instead of throwing half the cost of the vehicle, the second stage, and instead of having to refurbish and take 3 weeks and 4 weeks and move it from the landing to the factory, back to the land, all of that goes away. And it's like an airplane that lands, discharges its passengers, refuels and takes off again. And so the cost of launch doesn't come down by the fact that you're carrying 5 times or 10 times or 20 times the weight. It comes down to a fraction of the launch cost. So if you think SpaceX is winning the game right now, which is launching like 90%, 85% of mass to orbit, when Starship comes, it goes online later this coming year, probably October, November next year, it just devastates the cost to orbit. So you have Blue Origin coming online with their wonderful rocket.
Yeah, impressive, truly impressive.
Yeah, but the problem is they still throw away the second stage. They still have to refurbish the sucker. They're where SpaceX was 7 years ago. Now they have a much bigger rocket, a very capable rocket, and it has plans to expand to a much bigger rocket as well. But they're 5 to 7 years behind the game. And those 5 years, SpaceX will have data centers in the sky. And they take data centers into the sky for anyone else who wants to put a data center in the sky. Do you know that SpaceX's biggest competitors in the communications business, in the Starlink business, are going to space in what? In Falcon 9.
SpaceX rockets.
Yeah. And that's going to be the pattern for going forward for the future. And it's a long answer to your question. Why do they, you know, why would they, a competitor, use their rockets? That's why, because SpaceX has been a fantastic launch partner to anybody who wants to come along and get on their ship.
So is that a premeditated decision by Elon and the SpaceX team that says we want to play this way? Or is it like a function of Starlink / space satellite capacity doesn't marry directly? Like they have additional launch capacity available in the rocket company. But like, let's say, is there a scenario where they're going to make so many Starlink satellites and so many AI satellites, inference compute satellites in space, that could take up 100% of their launch cadence at some point, and that's not going to allow anybody else to jump on? Is that a risk?
No, it's not a risk. Look, Elon always speaks about competitors with respect.
Yeah, he does.
When they deserve it. Sometimes they do crazy things and they don't deserve it. But
he does both. He either shows a lot of respect or he throws them under the bus.
He shows respect when he feels respect, and he throws them under the bus when he doesn't feel respect. And he's, you know, he's pretty tough in that regard. But look, I don't know whether it's Elon, but it's consistent with Elon's philosophy. I don't know whether it's Gwyneth, but that management team decided a long time ago that that was going to be their philosophy. It's a philosophy that carries through all of SpaceX. So they're very competitive, but they're also very civil to their competitors, unless there's some issue that their competitors throw at them. That's the way I think it's been.
And what's fascinating about that strategy too is, if you really think about it, if you're a really good partner to literally anybody who wants to throw stuff up in space, and you open up your launch capacity for those people, then in those companies, then the forcing function for a competitor to go and try to compete with you goes down. But that's only true because they have built such a almost quasi monopolistic advantage because of how they solve for reusability, that for anybody to want to compete with them and like to actually take significant enough market share is going to be doubly difficult, because people are like, yeah, I'm just going with SpaceX. It's fine. Like the competitor would have to undercut SpaceX. Mm-hmm. And for them to undercut SpaceX means that they need a better rocket than Starship now.
Well, there are better rockets coming. The Chinese are very close to building a Starship. They have already built a Falcon. It failed on its first flight just a week or two ago. But, the Chinese
they're fighters.
They're going to get there. And so their Falcon clone is going to get to space and be recoverable within this coming year. We know that a New Glenn, this massive new rocket of Blue Origin, is now functionally able to land a booster. It's a big rocket, and it's able to land a booster, and it's operational, before Starship becomes operational. So they have a little bit of edge there, and the problem is they don't have production capacity. They're producing such an expensive rocket that they really don't have production capacity, and they can't really compete. ULA is non-competitive at all. Their rocket is very expensive, and it's fully
DOA.
Yeah, they talked about recovering just the engines, but it's been talked for so long. I mean, maybe they'll get there. Anyway, the bottom line is that Starship is very difficult to compete against, and sometime later in the new year, it's going to become operational. I suspect by October, September, October, the end of this third quarter or the beginning of the fourth quarter, and it'll become operational. And then we'll start seeing data centers being lifted to the sky, as well as much larger communication satellites. So it's an interesting period we're moving into, because SpaceX has had a monopoly, and now it's going to become a duopoly or triopoly.
Yeah. So it's just such a fascinating time. And I think this sort of piggybacks really nicely into sort of my next question, which is, when you became when did you invest in SpaceX for the first time, Larry? What year was this?
2022. It must have been 2022, yeah.
Got it. And then before that, obviously, you've been investing in other private companies, angel investing, sort of doing, investing in startups and everything. But there are sort of these, like, I'm sure, common threads and things you look for when you're trying to identify these types of breakthroughs earlier on. And SpaceX had been around for a long time. Everybody who follows your story knows you've been a big fan of space, of rockets, for a really long time. It's been one of your, JFK and going to the moon has inspired you in so many different ways. It's like, it exudes, you know, it's like every time I talk to you, I can just feel your passion. And so obviously it's very aligned with that passion, but you've also invested in a lot of the other companies that have become very, very successful that you may have been looking for the same type of variables as you would in a SpaceX. So like, so now that we're entering this very interesting time, I'm assuming you're looking around and you're like, there's going to be a lot of opportunity here. There's going to be a lot of companies coming up that are either piggybacking on this AI satellite in space. You know, if I give you my layman way that I'm looking at this, and then you tell me how I'm thinking about this and sort of go into your philosophy, what's becoming very obvious to me is that inference compute, the horsepower needed to run extremely advanced AI will happen because of satellites in space, because of Starship. That's going to open the door for God knows how many different new opportunities and new industries and new companies to be birthed from having a, I don't want to say a surplus of super intelligence, but like a significantly more intelligence for each human to be able to leverage to get stuff done, right? Does that change your investing thesis? Does that change how you approach looking at companies, how you approach investing in companies, or is there a certain sort of blueprint that you've been following that that is also going to be successful during this next cycle? How are you thinking about this? Does that question even make sense? I don't even know.
Yeah,
if
no,
just made
it
sense.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, when you invest in private companies, you have a very different set of problems from investment in public companies. So when you invest in public companies, you search for companies that are aligned with your investment objectives, with your taste for risk, and so you're able to use the enormous amounts of material that is generated, not of data that is generated by these public companies, to narrow down your searches with the overriding level of trust based upon the, you know, excellent framework of laws and rules and practices that we have around public companies in the United States and in the Western world in general. Although I classically have not strayed much from U.S. investments in the last 20 years because of my level of comfort with the U.S. Economy and the U.S. Entrepreneurs and the U.S. Regulatory system.
Laws and regulations, yep. Yeah.
So set that aside and now think about wanting to invest in private companies. Why would you want to? The first issue in any structure that you decide to invest in is, you know, what are your objectives? Why do you want to invest? And my interest in investing in private companies is because of three things. One is the upside opportunity is very much greater. I'll talk about the risks that presents, but by and large, you can afford several failures, multiple failures, maybe as much as 9 failures for one success. Whereas in a public company, you can't really look for a failure of more than 1 or 2 out of 3 because the margins and the upside is relatively low compared to the private company. So the risks are much greater, but the rewards are very much greater. And if you are sufficiently capable of selecting the right company, your upside is pretty good. And that leads to what I'm going to talk about in terms of approach, because without a really well-considered approach and a lot of experience, it's very difficult to choose that one company out of 10 or one coming out of 4 or 1 coming out of 5 that is going to outperform so significantly that it's going to give you that outside return. That make sense?
100%.
So to choose such a company, you either have to be a brilliant analyst, a brilliant, you know, mind reader, a brilliant reader of personality, and I'll tell you why personality in a few minutes, or And since very few of us are that level of brilliance, or you have to have a system that over time you have proven. Mm. And that system typically means there has to be a process that is repeatable so that you can look at, you know, 30 to 40 opportunities before you choose one. And that system has to be good enough to distinguish from the 30 or 40, the one, you know, that will be outstanding. Maybe 30 is an exaggeration, but it could be as many as 30. But you know, you hopefully you have a process that eliminates what is 90% of the stuff, which is a guy with an idea and with no background in the area of his idea and so on and so forth, all the way to somebody who's capable with a really good idea, but not all the tools, not all the tools or capability of executing.
Yeah.
And then to the person who combines all of the good things in one or two or three or four founders that together with this great idea has got an opportunity. Then when you select that guy, you've got a 1 in 10 chance or 1 in 5 chance or 1 in 20 chance, but a low enough risk that, you know, it makes that equation that I talked about earlier operational.
Yeah.
So you have to have a process, and that process has to be, you know, one of discovery, one of discrimination, one of test, and then one of approval. So you go through these stages, and the discovery has to be on multiple levels. It has to be first the general market for that product or that idea. It has to look at the total addressable market, what portion of the addressable market is possibly, you know, achievable. And then it has to look at all the things that have to be done, that have to be achieved in order to win that market. And then it has to look at the capability of the team to be able to generate that. And then it has to look at, you know, the total capital, has to do the numbers to build the capital to see how much would be needed to get to that point. And then it has to look at the financial results. So that diligence requires process. The process can be formal, or it can be semi-formal, or it can be very informal, depending on the kind of investor you are. But without all of those components, you're really, you know, you could be throwing your line into the vast sea without any knowledge of whether there's a fish there or not, and whether the fish will bite your dynavate and so on and so forth. So it's very important to have a process. It's very important to not necessarily tick every box in that process and do every function in that process, but that process be sufficiently exhaustive that by the time you make your decision, you're well informed as to the quality of the people, the quality of the idea, the quality and size of the market, and the opportunity that this company has of achieving the delivery of that product to the market and earning sufficient to pay back whatever it costs to invest. And before you invest, you have to make sure that the company is going to raise the level of money in total, if you're not providing at all, to achieve it. That's the broadest umbrella I can give you of how to approach it. Now, when you approach an Elon company, a lot of things are given.
Elon's doing it, so just invest.
Kind of like that. And, you know, that's part of the process, is evaluating the founder's capability, skill, and ability to execute, including the raising of the money.
Yeah.
So when you invest in an Elon company, you look at his track record. And his track record is, you know, one semi-failure out of six public companies. And the SolarCity was the semi-failure, which he ultimately absorbed into Tesla and turned into a winner.
Yeah.
And all he did was invest in that company. He didn't run that company. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that Elon is one of the best investors in the world.
Yeah.
And if you follow his investments now, it's interesting because I once turned up information on his investments, on his on the few handful, maybe five investments he's made outside his own companies, where he's invested in, you know, projects or in startups, and he's done incredibly well in those.
Wow.
Earning nothing in the billions that remotely equals what he's earned in his companies, but this is early in his career, and he invested, you know, in some fund, in some companies, and I think they were Altman-sponsored companies, actually, back in the day. And all of them did incredibly well. He didn't fail. He didn't make one bad investment. So wow. You're talking about a guy with, you know, absolute skill at seeing the future and understanding what it takes to get there and making the investment. So that's interesting in and of itself. But you're right. When Elon makes investment, the best is just to follow him. And my best illustration of that was my decision to invest in his attempt to buy Twitter.
Mm.
The day he announced that he was going to make a bid for Twitter, I reached out to investors I knew would be investing in that, due to funds I knew would be investing in that, said, guys, we've got to get into this. And he said, well, it's, you know, it looks very dire. I don't know. I said, guys, we've got to get into this.
Yeah.
And I was able to place not a lot of money, I think a total of $500,000 of family funds into that investment. You know what those are worth today?
A lot more than that.
I mean, I don't know. We've made, I don't know, 12X or 20X. I don't even, wow. I haven't done the numbers. But actually, I do have the numbers somewhere. I should pull them up. Yeah.
It's a big number.
A big number. And, you know, and I don't like boasting about numbers and stuff. But, yeah. So the X, yeah, we made, well, it's only 1.5 times our money. But it also led to XAI.
Right.
XAI, where we've made quite a bit more than that. But the point is that judgment was so heavily weighted for the the founder. You're the founder of X.
The operator. Yeah.
The operator. That I didn't even look at the other factors.
Fascinating.
I didn't do the diligence that I normally do. I didn't have the information, but I made the investment without that information.
And what's fascinating about that is this is a concept that I think through a lot, is like the art of investing, the art of like deploying the capital. It's in a lot of situations, I think it's a lot more art than science, because it's like you have to kind of create it. You have to make a judgment call that says, okay, you had those four variables that you walked us through, was the founder, the staff, the idea, the market, right? But depending on what you're looking at, one of them, it could be equal weight. The other one could be the founder is 90% of the weight. The other one is the idea is 90% of the weight.
Yeah, but right? At the end of the day, the ability to raise the money is never. I mean, you may have a founder with absolute proven ability to raise money, so that maybe you're right in that regard, but remember, if you have
Altman.
If you have a great founder, but the market's very tight and that founder is great, he's done well, but you don't think he can raise the money, you know, then that I guess the ability to raise money is based upon the founder's track record as well. So in a way, the two track together.
And ability to sell too, right? I think founders that might not have a great track record, but they're very good salesmen or women, I think that also allows them to bring money in, right?
So I think what we're saying is that these factors do play into each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a founder maybe is not as strong as he should be, but he's got an incredible team under him, you know, that has some weight. Although depending on where the weaknesses are in the founder's eye, In one case, I mean, I didn't invest in a company that this company is part of, was invested by a fund in which I'm a limited partner. It was the most promising company in their stable. They asked me to look into it and do a investment alongside them because this company was going through another round and they're actively out there raising money, and they sent me to do an investment in it. I met with the founder, and for various reasons, which are not important here, but I declined the investment because I felt the founder didn't have all the skills, didn't have the 360 degrees, and was missing some serious skills that indicated to me he's not the right person to lead the company. Well, within a year, they had brought in another CEO.
And then you invested?
Well, that's the interesting question. I declined to invest again.
Wow, how come?
Because when I said I wasn't going to invest, and I intimated, not in so many words, but that I didn't have confidence in the founder, I think they started to look seriously at the founder's role. The founder himself, I shouldn't say him, he or her.
That person. Said,
yeah.
They.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
They appeared to me not that excited about leading the company anyway. Which, wow. You know, you don't want in a leader of a company.
Yeah, 100%.
And so it became clear to the fund that they should find, you know, somebody to run the company. And then they brought in somebody, turned out not to be the right person, and it wasn't really to run the company, but to run alongside. Anyway, after that, they brought in the leader. So I said to myself, this is too risky because we've seen all this change taking place. Company's doing okay during this period, and they've actually raised additional money, but there are clear signs that all is not yet perfect. Failed scoring. If I'd come into this company fresh and I'd been scoring them on my methodology and they'd gone through the process, management structure, or more like management stability has not yet been proven. So management structure is one thing, management quality is another thing, but management stability is perhaps an overarching issue that goes above everything else. So yeah, I'd love to invest in this company. It does great work. It's got an incredible customer base. It has incredible opportunity. But that level of stability of management could upset the entire apple cart and render it worthless. So what I'm saying is that every time you assess a company, you have to go through the entire litany. You have to go, you know, it's like a religious ceremony. You got to do everything in exactly the order set by the book. Otherwise, you know, you won't be ordained. So that's it.
And what's crazy about that too, and I know you got to jump here in a minute or two, it can be the same exact company, the same exact leader, the same exact team, the same exact idea, the same exact market, but just the time could have rendered something different.
Exactly.
You know, the leader's personal life is getting in the way. Maybe something, the culture has soured because management is not paying attention. Maybe regulations just came out that significantly impacted the market, right? So even though it might look static, there is a subset of things that could have changed within those things that you have to re-engage in every single time you check a touch base with that company. Is that fair?
That is fair. And so your process, all the questions you ask, all the forms you fill out, all your process should be able to touch upon all those things. And then above and beyond that, your instinct when you meet with management, when you meet with customers, and when you meet with suppliers, which you should do in every company, that should be part of your career. And when you meet with staff, you should be aware that there may be something that occurs that you haven't come across in the past, but that throws a red light. And you should be open to your process not covering sufficient ground, that you discover new things every time. And every time you invest in a company and there's a failure, that adds to your, that may add to your list of things that I should have caught that. That was a fatal flaw in the whole structure. I should have caught that earlier.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, on top of all of that, I have invested in companies, and even in recent years, even in these last couple of years when I'm, you know, kind of aging out of the business, I've invested in companies just on instinct and without doing the due diligence when the money is small enough and the opportunity is intriguing and exciting. And in more than half of those, I've lost everything that I'd put in at first. But that's not a bad number.
Right.
That is not a bad number, because the number is small. The, you know, the upside is gigantic. And if one in 20 hit, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not something I would encourage in anybody who's starting out in this business. I would encourage them to develop a very strong framework that their experience and background teaches them is the right framework. And at the end of the day, if you don't have a huge amount of experience in building companies from the ground up, you probably shouldn't be in this business.
Love it. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Larry. I don't know if you want to plug Lumacenti or not, because I feel like this is like Lumacenti, I almost view like your and Bradford's shared experience and this exact methodology that's going into actually picking those companies. Did you want to talk about that real quick before you go?
Well, yeah. And, you know, anybody's welcome to write to me and say we'd like to be part of Lumacenti. Brad and I formed Lumacenti to invest in companies that we love and want to invest our own money into. And we just in the process of closing our first funding of a company that we are absolutely besotted with. We think it's a great company. We love the people, we love the product, we love the space. And so we're very excited about our first investment. But, you know, you really need to do a lot of diligence before you invest in any company, even Lumacenti. And so write to me and, you know, let me know you're interested. My DMs are always open. Just send me a DM and I'll respond.
Love it. At Tesla Larry on X, and I'll have a link for Lumacenti in the description and comment section below. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Larry.
Thank
you,
Faza.
Super nice of you. This was awesome. Thank you. Stick around for a second for me.